Hello and welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines, but who do not declare to be politics experts. It's okay if you don't really know what's going on, if you're not glued to the news every day of your entire life. It's fine. I'll always explain and contextualize everything that I talk about on this podcast. So you will, I promise you, come away feeling genuinely informed. No pretending required. I'm Julia Bell, and today I can't resist. I know this has been a thing for a while, but I can't resist doing a podcast about this whole Matt Hancock kissing his not wife in the corridors of Whitehall when the guidance at the time was very clearly, you aren't even allowed to hug people you don't live with. And he didn't live with her. So we've got to talk about the kind of hypocrisy of it, but also the fallout from it. Him resigning, even though, did he really want to initially? And then, of course, we've got to talk about Sajid Javid taking over as health secretary midway through a pandemic and what that might look like. So there is so much to discuss here. I know a lot of people have been talking about it all weekend. The memes have been out of control glorious, but I can't resist throwing my two cents in and, of course, clearing everything up for anyone who might have missed certain aspects, because there's more layers to this than you'd think. Listen, this was Matt Hancock when he announced that he was resigning on Saturday the 26th of June.
I've been to see the Prime Minister to resign as Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign. It's an interesting way to put it, to be honest, because as far as I'm concerned, it's not actually really why he's resigning, this idea of him not sticking to the rules, because the video of him kissing his colleague was dated the 6th of May. That CCTV footage was from the 6th of May. That's almost 2 months ago. And yet he's only resigning now. So the sentiment to me feels a little bit more like those of us who make the rules have got to stick by them. And if we don't, we ought to not get caught. And that's why I've got to resign. But maybe that's just semantics. Listen, I'm going to run through the whole story top to bottom. That being said, make sure you're following me on social media at JuliaBell_X, because you've been sending me loads of questions for this episode. So I'm going to kind of weave my way through those various topics that you want more info on. And before I do get started, can I just ask you a favour? If you find this podcast helpful, share it. Please share it with your loved ones, share it with your friends. Most importantly, share it with people who pretend to know what they're talking about when they don't. Those are the ones that we need to hear this stuff. And it helps me such a lot. If you put it on your Instagram or if you tweet a link to it, then you're opening it up to a whole new world of people. And that's how I grow and keep this going. So as a personal favour to me, if this is going to be a juicy episode and you're going to enjoy it, do me a favour in return and share the episode for me. Okay. Now that I've done that, let's get on to this absolute juice fest of an episode. So just a quick run through then of the events that led to Matt Hancock's resignation. On Friday the 25th of June, the Sun newspaper published this massive front page splash of this screenshot that we've all seen now of CCTV footage from within the health department offices in Whitehall, so within Matt Hancock's office, of him snogging his aide, Gina Colodangelo. Matt Hancock is, or I suppose was, married to his university sweetheart, Martha Hancock. Together they have three kids, and Gina Colodangelo is also married with three kids as well. Interestingly, she's married to the founder of Oliver Bonus. I feel like I get told off because I'm Northern and I pronounce that weirdly. But yeah, she's married to Oliver Bonus founder. Oliver Tress is his name. And I love Oliver Bonus. It's such a nice shop. It's like really nice lifestyle stuff, clothes, accessories. Anyway, this is not an ad for Oliver Bonus. If anything, they're the biggest losers of this whole scenario. Anyway, she is married to him, three kids. Matt Hancock's married to Martha Hancock, three kids. And the level of scandal just on that front, you know, caught with your trousers down, having an extramarital affair, that's catastrophic in itself for a politician. But it's not career ruining. I mean, it kind of used to be in the old days, but Boris Johnson's been caught out having affairs before, so it certainly isn't career ruining on its own. This, therefore, is not a story about an affair. It's a story about hypocrisy. The reason for that, as I said in the introduction, was the CCTV footage was dated from the 6th of May. And at that time, perhaps you can't remember because we've had a lot of rules over a lot of time periods, but at the time of the 6th of May, in England at least, the guidance from the government was explicitly no hugging with people that you do not live with. And who was the most pious and the most kind of unbearably self-righteous? Who was the architect about those rules and about declaring the importance of them? Oh yeah, it was our hun Matt Hancock himself, who had in the not so distant past publicly shamed colleagues who had ignored those rules themselves. In fact, not even shamed them, encouraged them to resign. When I saw this splash, my mind immediately went to Professor Neil Ferguson, who was a government scientist. So he wasn't an elected person, but he was an advisor. So he still had a fair amount of authority about the pandemic. And back in May 2020, Neil Ferguson was caught having a relationship with a woman who he didn't live with. She visited his home when lockdown restrictions forbade him from doing that. And Matt Hancock, the pioneer of righteousness when it comes to these fucking guidelines, was one of the first to publicly declare how unacceptable that was. Have a listen.
I mean, what did you think when you read it? Did you bang your head on the desk?
Well, it's just, it's extraordinary. And, you know, I don't understand.
Sounds speechless.
I am. That doesn't often happen to me, Kay.
I know.
And, but I am, I am. And, you know, I think that it's I think that he took the right decision.
You wouldn't have...
To resign, that
yeah,
is.
You wouldn't have thought to keep him.
It's just not, that's just not possible in these circumstances.
Final thought, just before we move on to the next question. I mean, one of his defences was that he'd already had COVID.
So I asked exactly that question of the chief medical officer. Can I behave differently because I've now had it? Do I still have to do the social distancing? And the answer was very clear, which is yes.
So there you go. Matt Hancock on Sky News back in early May 2020, back when he was the golden boy of these restrictions, saying he was made, quote, speechless by Professor Neil Ferguson's actions, saying he, quote, wouldn't have fought to keep him, and that he took the right decision to resign. Oh, how the tables have turned. But here's the thing, the hypocrisy of this is just, in my opinion, the tip of the iceberg. Hancock preaching these rules like he's the Pope of the pandemic and then getting caught canoodling with his aide, who he very much does not live with, within the walls of the institution in which he designed the guidance he was ignoring. Yes, that's one element of it, the hypocrisy. Is it painful? Yes. Does it make you violently angry? Sure. Have we had to go to funerals via Zoom? Yes. Have we only had access to our fucking grandparents via a window in their care home while we watch them shoulder the ultimate burden of loneliness? Yes. Have single people, like myself, been literally forbidden by our own governments from developing new, genuine connections because of the restrictions that Hancock made while he canoodles with a woman who he's not even married to? Sure, that's a part of it. However, the hypocrisy, in my view, is baseline. This is actually a much bigger story. There are bigger questions that we need to be asking. Number one is, what's the story with this aide? Who is she and what's their relationship? Now, you might be thinking, that seems like a gossipy question. Why is that the focal point? Well, I'll tell you, Gina Colodangelo, who is a mate, she's like an old mate of Hancock's. They've known each other for a long time. Their relationship goes way back to their days at the Oxford University radio station, which I can't mock because I did university radio. So we'll move briskly on from that. He brought in Gina Colodangelo, his old mate, first off as an unpaid advisor, but then he promoted her to become a non-executive director within the health department. What does that mean? It means that she got to sit on a board. It means she got to rub shoulders with the likes of Chris Whitty and have a similar level of authority when it came to scrutinising and holding Matt Hancock to account within his decisions as health minister. This is a high-powered, very important, very integral, salaried job. Around £15,000 of taxpayer money. And you might think that sounds awfully low, but it's actually only for about 15 to 20 days of work. So it's very much a part-time thing that she could do on top of her full-time job, which was a communications director at her husband's company, Oliver Bonus. I'm not sure how long she'll remain in that job, but that's by the by. The reason that her relationship with Hancock is, in my opinion, deserving of public scrutiny is to understand if there was a direct conflict of interest when she was paid on our dime. Let me talk you through the timelines. Matt Hancock recruited her to be a government aide in September 2020. And so if they were lovers already, then what we have, my friends, is a conflict of interest. So the next question there is, were the proper protocols followed in her recruitment? Was it rigorous? Was the proper paperwork done, or were shortcuts taken? And if shortcuts were taken in order for him to get an old pal who he kind of fancied into a government role so that it gave him an opportunity to spend more time with her, then that raises much bigger, much more ominous questions about how government aides are recruited. Full stop. Because I at least would like to be assured that our tax pounds that have never been more valuable than now during a pandemic are being spent appropriately on people who genuinely have the expertise to be in these positions and who are genuinely doing the job while they're in those walls rather than canoodling in corridors. Not to mention, this isn't just an ethical thing. This isn't just me saying he ought to not bring in his lovers to do these important jobs. This is a ministerial code thing. Because a conflict of interest is, it basically breaks every ministerial code in the book. So this isn't just me voicing my opinion, this is the law. So I think it's quite important, and that, to me, goes beyond the kind of baseline hypocrisy of the thing. And of course, it's not just me that's pissed off by this. The Labour Party are on the case. So Angela Rayner, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, tweeted on the 25th of June. So actually, this was before Hancock resigned. She tweeted a picture of this letter, this public letter that she wrote to Boris Johnson, which basically demanded that he publish in full all the paperwork involved with recruiting Colodangelo. Let us see that you've actually followed protocols here. And if you haven't, we have the right to know. I don't know if that letter will get a reply, let's be honest. But this issue of how ministers appoint their aides, I really hope that doesn't fade away as an issue, because I'm dying to know what protocols were followed, if any. And if all the other government aides, for which there are hundreds, if not thousands, how they got their jobs as well. Okay, so we've covered the hypocrisy, we've covered the conflicts of interest. Now we've got to talk about this footage, this CCTV footage, and more importantly, how it got into the hands of the Sun newspaper. Because this is footage from a kind of CCTV camera inside Whitehall, which is, I thought, pretty ironclad when it came to security, because this is where the most sensitive and secretive decisions are being made by the health secretary during a pandemic. Really, it ought to be quite a secure place. So how did this happen? Now, this isn't me saying I wish the footage hadn't been leaked. Of course, I personally am glad that this footage came out. Maybe you have different views, but I've had the worst 18 months of my life. We've all been through various struggles. And to know that our own health secretary was brazenly ignoring the very protocols that he designed, I'm glad I know that information. And I'm glad that he stepped down as a result, frankly. But this issue of security still is important. We still need to work out, hang on, are they just being recorded? And is this footage likely to be leaked whenever leakers fancy it? I think that's swinging the pendulum too far the other way. That is a worry as well. And that is something that Jeremy Hunt, who was the health secretary between 2012 and 2018, so he used to have Hancock's job, he shared his views about that topic on the Andrew Marr show on Sunday.
I mean, it's completely unacceptable from a security point of view that ministers are being filmed inside their own offices without their knowledge. And so there'll be issues that our intelligence agencies will want to look at very, very carefully. But there's also another issue, which is that ministers do need to have the ability to have frank, private conversations with their senior officials to debate things so that they can understand issues and know that those conversations will remain private if they're going to be able to go through the thought processes that enable them to make the right decisions. And so I think that will also be something on the minds of government ministers today.
Jeremy Hunt there, former health secretary, saying this is, you know, this is not a good thing if ministers are scared of being recorded all the time, because they will just ultimately be impeded from doing their jobs. So, and I think he's right, to be honest. So are we ever going to find out who leaked this thing? Here's a tricky thing, right? And Hunt alluded to it in his chat with Andrew Marr. If the government just witch hunts the shit out of this leaker, and if they conduct a full-scale, you know, all-guns-blazing leak inquiry, then the leaker could theoretically declare whistleblower status. And that means they would technically be protected, completely protected, because they shared something with the public that they deemed to be a quote-unquote wrongdoing of an elected official. So they could claim, I deserve protection because I did something that was in the public's best interest. I did them a service. And when I say protection, I mean legal protection against, for instance, any charges for breaking security rules or for reneging on a contract that they might have signed to keep secrets, for example. Because I'm sure that lots of people who work within the civil service have to sign essentially NDAs. And, you know, declaring whistleblower status would protect them from any kind of legal consequences about breaking those promises. So the government has to kind of tread a line here. And at the moment, the common understanding is that Downing Street is not going to go down that route and to do a full-blown inquiry. They're going to avoid that for that reason. What we will see, for sure, we're not just going to see everyone ignore this. Of course, this is like a fucking crisis in terms of the health department. So what we are going to see is the Department of Health doing an internal investigation into what happened. Of course they will. So speaking to people, tracing who had access to the footage, tightening security in the future, if not taking these cameras down altogether. I mean, Jeremy Hunt said in that interview that he didn't know that there were CCTV cameras in those positions in Whitehall. So if the ministers don't even know the cameras are there, perhaps there'll be a look into, okay, what cameras are there? Why are they here? Can we take them down? I think, you know, if you were a government minister and you saw this story come out, don't you think your first port of call would be to swing by the security office on your way in next time to say, hey, show me what cameras there are. Can we get rid of them, please? So, of course, that will happen. But will we hear the results of that investigation? Not necessarily, because it's internal. And sadly, that might mean that we won't find out who leaked this, because I got to tell you, I'm dying to know. Again, there's some speculation as to who it was. It's common understanding that it was a staffer within the Department of Health. So it was someone who did work there. And it obviously was somebody who did not approve of what Matt Hancock was up to. And word on the street is that this person was, let's say, a lockdown skeptic. So this particular staffer was pissed off with the constant restrictions and the constant pushing back of reopening dates. And they kind of snapped when they saw Matt Hancock breaking his own rules. So, you know, that's the common understanding. But again, I'll say it multiple times. Nothing's been confirmed. No names have been shared. All right, well, flying through this, hypocrisy, check. Conflict of interest, check. CCTV footage being leaked and the debate around that, check. Now we have to talk about Matt Hancock's emails. There's just so much to this. How am I not going to go over an hour talking about this? Okay, I'm going to try. So, do you remember, when was it? Last year? November time, potentially? Last year, when Matt Hancock got a load of flack for allegedly handing massively lucrative NHS contracts to one of his pals. It was this pub landlord that was his neighbour in Suffolk, his constituency. So this guy, this neighbour, Alex Bourne, along with sort of his history of being a pub landlord, he now owns this packaging company, like a packaging manufacturing company. And the company's called Hinpak. They usually make takeaway boxes. it's so random I can't cope. They usually make takeaway boxes, but this Alex Bourne man reached out to Hancock, his old neighbour, his old buddy, and said, hey, I know that I make takeaway boxes, but can I offer my company's services, my factory's services to the NHS in exchange for a lot of money? So Alex Bourne's story, this pub landlord come package maker guy, his story is that he sent Hancock a message on WhatsApp offering his services, and Hancock simply replied, again via WhatsApp, with a link to the official Department of Health site, basically saying, here's your link, you do have to go and apply properly. So that was the first story. Then it kind of came out from Alex Bourne that, okay, we have had quite a lot of back and forth via email and WhatsApp and whatever over a series of months. And what do you know, Bob's your uncle. A few months after those initial messages, the health department gets in touch with Alex Bourne and says, do you fancy making tens of millions of vials for COVID tests? And if you've done a COVID test, you'll know what I mean. It's those sort of plastic, twisty cap vials that you pop your swab in. Probably everyone listening to this podcast has at some point done one of those COVID tests, and therefore you know how much money Alex Bourne will have made from that contract. Bear in mind, this is a guy who makes takeaway boxes. And there are companies out there that make those twisty cap vials, but what does it matter? It's a pandemic, no rules apply. Anyway, we all remember that story, and it kind of unearthed this debate about how contracts were being secured. So it was this overall story of cronyism, which is the word being used, which is just like a jargony word for when government officials give favours to their mates and look after their mates and try and get them insider ways to make massive profits off the back of essentially a national tragedy. And, you know, without forcing them to compete for those deals. That's cronyism, and this story unearthed that. And so in the same vein this week, another scandal has cropped up. This time, though, not about WhatsApp, but about Matt Hancock's alleged use of his private email address rather than his government official email address. You know, when he's been dealing with this official pandemic stuff, like handing out massive contracts. So this time it was the Sunday Times that published the scoop, and they obtained documents that showed that Matt Hancock had been using his private email address when discussing pandemic-related business. You might be thinking, why is that a problem? You might be listening thinking, sometimes I use my private email address instead of my work one. Who cares? Okay, when you're a government minister, let me tell you the two main problems with using your private email address when sorting out a pandemic. Number one, accountability. If you use your official government email address, then that means that the government has a direct record of all of your discussions, all of your decision-making. It has copies of every protocol that you followed. It has copies of all the attachments that you had on emails, everything. Which means if there's ever an inquiry, then any evidence about that topic can be dragged up and looked into. The government can access that without your say. So if you use your personal email, the records of all of your conversations belong to you. And so if, for instance, a newspaper through freedom of information requests access to your private emails to understand what you've been doing, then it's up to you how much you disclose. That kind of goes against the ministerial conduct for obvious reasons. So accountability is one thing. It's probably the main thing. But you know what? Security is another. If you're dealing with hundreds of millions of pounds worth of government contracts and you're recruiting aides and you're giving them passes that let them into every room in Westminster, if you're doing this stuff on your fucking Gmail account, right? It doesn't even bear saying this stuff. If you're doing it on your Gmail account rather than your government email, which is protected by government security software and firewalls galore, you're asking for trouble security-wise. And you're not particularly taking seriously how sensitive this information actually is. So it begs the question, if an intelligent person like Oxford University graduate, former economist, health secretary Matt Hancock, if you're an intelligent person, you know that using your Gmail account is not particularly secure. So then why are you using it? And guess who's on the case again? The Labour Party. They are having a field day with this whole story. So have a listen to this.
the use of private and therefore undocumented and unrecorded emails by government ministers during this emergency is a scandal. And if the government ministers have been engaging in poor conduct on private accounts with no transparency and no oversight in their departments, we'll never get a real inquiry into what happens. And these rules that govern what happens is to avoid cronyism and corruption. So using private emails is a very serious matter.
Angela Rayner there. I've mentioned her more in this podcast than ever before, but she's, as I said, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, and she's really not slowing down on this crusade to investigate Hancock's actions. And that was her on Good Morning Britain on the 28th of June. Here's the thing that's just annoying me about all of this. Yes, it's right that Hancock resigned, but now that he has resigned, does that mean that he doesn't have to answer all of these questions? You know, Rayner is pushing for a full investigation into this private email thing. She wants to find out what emails he sent and she wants access to those. But it feels a little bit like she's shouting into a void because he's stepped down and because Sajid Javid has taken over. So these are, yes, these are questions for Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. But is he even going to answer them, or is he going to claim, listen, I'm just so busy with the pandemic, I can't look into this right now? And then, yes, maybe this stuff will come out in the woodwork years down the line when they do a whole inquiry into the government's handling of the pandemic. But by that point, it'll be way too late to actually hold these people to account while they're still serving in these positions. So I hope I'm wrong. I hope we get definitive answers. But so far, the pattern has very much been, oh my God, the press has dug something massive up. It's a huge scandal. The government deny and ignore it. And then it fades away. And then the next scandal comes out and we all get outraged by that. And so the loop continues ad infinitum. And along that pattern, Downing Street, of course, was asked about this email thing. What do you think about Matt Hancock using his private emails? And the Prime Minister's spokesman said, quote, "My understanding is that Hancock's use of his private emails was related to things like diary acceptances." So he probably never did anything that important on there. It's nothing to get upset about. That account does not ring true with what the Sunday Times published, because they said he was handling all sorts of COVID-related business on his private email address. But hopefully we'll get more details. Okay, nearly there with this, to be honest. A couple more things to just cover before I run out the door and go on a date, if that's okay with you, Mr. Hancock. So we've got to talk about Boris Johnson. I know I've touched on him just before, but let's unpack his response to all of this, shall we? Because frankly, his account keeps changing. When the news initially broke, Johnson backed Matt Hancock. He did not demand his resignation. He did not declare that he was firing him. The sentiment was very much, he can stay in his job. I trust him. And so the story went that both Hancock and Johnson were kind of hoping that he could stick around, but pressure from lots of actually conservative MPs, so pressure within their own party, I think apparently it's 80 Tory MPs, were kind of metaphorically banging on the door at Downing Street, sending angry emails, leaving angry voicemails saying he has to go. There's just no way this guy can stay after this horrific scandal. And so then Matt Hancock, after all that pressure, eventually conceded and resigned the next day, to which Boris Johnson said he was, quote, sorry to receive his resignation. I remember at the time, it was only a couple of days ago, I thought that was weird. I thought watching that video of Matt Hancock snogging Gina Colodangelo, surely the guy has to go. My cousin was texting me about it like, nah, there's no way he'll leave. And I was saying, he has to. It's not a matter of can he stay? No. But he kind of clung on, didn't he? And that was how the story went. Boris Johnson backed him and he was sorry to see him go. But cut to today, so today's the 28th of June, a couple of days later, as I'm recording this podcast, it was about an hour ago that a video has just come out of this journalist who kind of stopped Boris Johnson in the street while he's out in Batley campaigning, because there's a by-election happening up there. And they asked him about this. They said, do you think that you should have fired him rather than letting him resign? To which Boris Johnson essentially completely changed his account of the entire story. Have a listen to this.
Well, I read the story on Friday, and we've got a new health secretary in post on Saturday, and I think that's about the right pace to proceed in a pandemic. And actually, I had a good conversation yesterday, a long meeting with Sajid Javid, the new health secretary, and we went over the data in great detail.
So there he is saying, well, I read the story on Friday, he was gone by the Saturday, that's the right pace for a resignation in a pandemic. I don't know about you, but to me that sounded like he was taking credit for the fact that Hancock had to go, which directly contradicts his earlier statement when he said he was, quote, sorry to see his resignation. In other words, he wanted him to stay. So which is it, Mr. Johnson? Part of me can't help but think, have you just watched the public be in total outcry and thought, oh my goodness, I need to be on the right side of history here. I ought to make out like sacking Hancock was my idea. Hard to say. What I will say, though, is the fact that Hancock, in his mind, even for one split second, thought he could stay in that job blows my fucking mind. Let's move forward, kind of hypothetically, to winter time when COVID is even more of a threat, right? Touch wood, we won't have any new variants and the vaccine rollout will go successfully and we won't need any further restrictions. But there's a chance we will. If Matt Hancock had stayed in his job, how in God's good green earth could Matt Hancock ever have had the authority to tell us to abide by those restrictions when we've got a video of him essentially urinating all over the restrictions that he set last time? Pardon my language. So just for the sake of the public being able to take instruction from the people in charge, Hancock couldn't stick around. It couldn't be done. And I hope that Boris Johnson recognised that, and therefore I hope that Boris Johnson's sort of second version of events is the accurate one. Okay, finally then, just a quick segment on Matt Hancock's replacement, Sajid Javid. He is this cabinet veteran. He has done it, you know. In other words, he's been the Home Secretary and he's been the Chancellor, which are two of the big ones. Like on a chessboard, they are like the bishops and the knights. Do you know what I mean? This is no pawn shit. So he's done these jobs. Whether he's done them well is up to you. Maybe that's a conversation for another time, but he's done big gigs. And he, you might remember when he was the Chancellor, he got into a pretty public row with Dominic Cummings back when he was involved. So this is February 2020, just before the pandemic really took hold of the UK. And the story at the time, so we're in February 2020, Sajid Javid is the Chancellor. The story at the time was that Boris Johnson was doing this huge cabinet reshuffle. And it was kind of brutal, like he fired loads of people and replaced them with fresh meat and just had this like complete new approach. And apparently at the time, Boris Johnson went to Sajid Javid and said, right, I'm doing this cabinet reshuffle. You can keep your job if you fire all of your advisors. We don't like what they've been doing. We're not really sold on your whole vibe. Get rid of them and then you can keep your job. And Sajid Javid turned around, and this is public knowledge because he said it to the journalist. He said, no self-respecting minister would do that, so I'm out of here, I'm done. And that's when, of course, we saw Rishi Sunak take over, and then the poor guy got hit with a national pandemic literally weeks later, and that would have been just the worst month for him. But Sajid Javid stepped down, and I think at the time he made it pretty public that his qualm wasn't with Boris Johnson. He interpreted that this instruction to fire his staff was actually from Dominic Cummings. That was where the row was. And they did not see eye to eye on anything. I think Dominic Cummings thought that Sajid Javid was way too frugal and he didn't believe in any of the advice he was getting. And Sajid Javid thought that Cummings was taking over government and he wasn't elected and it wasn't fair. And it was this whole battle. So now that Dominic Cummings is history, frankly, it means that Sajid Javid and Boris Johnson's relationship is kind of on the mend. And they're on, I suppose, better terms. And, you know, Sajid Javid never came out and said anything disparaging about Boris Johnson when he left in February 2020. So that meant that the door was still open for him to come back, which he now is. Not to mention, Sajid Javid has this very strong relationship with Boris Johnson's wife, Carrie Johnson. He even went to her 30th birthday for example, which Dominic Cummings was very quick to jump on. In fact, he tweeted, when Sajid Javid was announced as the replacement, he tweeted, Carrie has made this appointment. In fact, let me get the tweet up for you and I'll read it properly. Right, here it is. It's full of jargon, so I'll try my best. And he tweets very aggressively and it's intense. Okay, Dominic Cummings, 26th of June, he puts, so, Carrie appoints Sarge, exclamation mark. Note, if I hadn't tricked the Prime Minister into firing Sarge, we'd have had a Treasury with a useless Secretary of State, no furlough scheme, total chaos, instead of a joint number 10 and number 11 Downing Street team, which was a big success. Sarge is bog standard, he chases headlines, equals awful for the NHS. We need regime change. That's my translation of, honestly, you should look at this tweet, it's like so chaotic. So yeah, his best friend Carrie Johnson, kidding, there's severe hatred there. He's convinced that Carrie Johnson is basically pulling all the puppet strings and she's the one that got her mate Sajid Javid in the job. Hard to say for sure, that's Dominic Cummings' perception. Anyway, I'm getting off track. The fact that he has had these cabinet positions, I guess, means that Boris Johnson is confident in his experience. And also, I think there's an element here of Sajid Javid has not been a huge supporter of all these lockdown restrictions. He's been one of these people who's like trying to focus everybody's attention on the economy a little bit more. He's been saying, come on, like, we've got to get out of this stuff as quickly as we can. Because he's like this globalist, he's a former banker. So he's very much into the money side. And I think, to be honest, that resonates with Boris Johnson's beliefs. You know, we all know that Boris Johnson did not want to do a second lockdown. And he was so reluctant to let that happen. So I think he's keen to have somebody who's a bit more on his page in the health department. Because as we know, Matt Hancock had a very conservative approach. He wanted to do lockdowns. He wanted all the restrictions. Not that he listened to them, but he wanted to roll out this really strict stuff. I think the belief is that Sajid Javid won't have the same focus. And basically, he's lived up to that because the first thing he said after being announced as the new health secretary was that he wanted to get back on track as quickly as possible. Have a listen to this.
I was honoured to take up this position. I also know that it comes with huge responsibility and I will do everything I can to make sure that I deliver for the people of this great country. We are still in a pandemic. And I want to see that come to an end as soon as possible. And that will be my most immediate priority, to see that we can return to normal as soon and as quickly as possible. Now, I've got a lot of work to do. I'm sure you appreciate that. And if you can excuse me, I'd like to get on with it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for coming.
Okay, Sajid Javid there on the 27th of June, making some big old promises. He's been described as confident. He's been described as bullish. One thing I will say is that if I were him and I had spent the last 18 months watching the government make promises and then go back on them, I would be very wary of doing the same thing within my first week of me taking up office, especially because, with all due respect, he hasn't been privy to all of the data and to all the information. He hasn't been there while Matt Hancock has been, you know, dealing with all this stuff for the last 18 months. He's kind of green, he's kind of clueless about what he's actually in for. Again, with the greatest respect, it's just fact. And it isn't just a pandemic that he needs to deal with. When you're health secretary, it's not just COVID that's on your in tray, so to speak. Let me just run you through some of the things that he is going to have on his agenda straight away. I'm not even in the next few months, like day one, what are we doing about this? So obviously, alongside dealing with the pandemic, there is the backlog of procedures and appointments for non-COVID related stuff in hospitals. We now have a waiting list of 5.1 million patients in England alone. That's the highest ever since modern records. He now, Sajid Javid, has to work out a way to wade through those backlogs while making sure we don't get more COVID peaks that push things back even more. That's number one. Number two, social care. His title is not just the Secretary of Health, it's the Secretary for Health and Social Care. It's on the plaque, on the front door. And yet, throughout this pandemic, it has felt very much like the social care element has been kind of neglected entirely. So, I mean, do you remember when Hancock claimed that he'd put a protective ring around care homes back in, spring last year? And he went on to say, we've ensured that they have all the resources they need. It was nonsense. COVID spread like wildfire in care homes. So Javid has to restore the faith that that actually is a priority for the Department of Health, because it certainly hasn't felt that way. So that's two things. Then we've got to think about mental health. The fallout from lockdown in terms of mental health, especially amongst young people, but to be honest, parents who have had to deal with kids out of school throughout lockdown, people who have lost their jobs, there is going to be this horrific ripple effect. And the NHS is going to need massive budgets and kind of untold levels of resources to deal with that. And it's kind of a blind issue. We don't know how bad it is until it's going to hit us. So I hope that that is something he's going to be thinking about day one, minute one. Then I've been thinking about this recently. He's got to think about long COVID. There's not much research into this. We don't know much about it. And it is something that I think has been creeping up on us as a serious issue. I don't know if you guys, if you're listening, if you know anybody who suffers with long COVID. There's a couple of people, I think there's somebody who went to my school. You know how you just kind of keep them on Facebook, even though you were never really friends and you don't know each other that well. There was somebody from my school who suffers from long COVID, and she talks about how she has these horrific headaches and she feels constantly foggy. She doesn't feel like herself. You know, she's been saying that she'd never got her sense of taste back. And, you know, there is research to suggest, preliminary research to suggest, that this is much more serious than we think. Could it have an impact on our brain? This is, I hope, something that he's preparing for, because this is kind of a long-term impact that may well creep up on us in 10 years' time, when an entire generation who are hit with COVID are dealing with consequences there. Then we've got, isn't this a fun list, by the way? Aren't you loving life listening to this? But this is serious. This is what Sajid Javid has to be taking seriously. I hope he is, while he's promising that it's all going to be over soon. He's got to deal with NHS staff. Waning morale is the terminology that the press are using. I think that's the biggest understatement I've ever heard, waning morale. I've had 10-minute voice notes from mates of mine who are nurses and medical workers saying, like, they are on the verge of a breakdown. And these people we have to somehow convince these people to stay in their jobs with basically no pay rise. I mean, that is another thing he's going to have to deal with, this infamous 1% pay rise that was offered to nurses and health workers. Is he going to find a way to increase that? Or is he going to watch as lots of people resign because they just can't take it anymore? That's one thing. And then, just to top it all off, as a little cherry on top of that pie of shit, he has to deal with, brace yourselves, the reality of more pandemics. Are we going to be better prepared next time? And I use this term next time, you know, with caution. We don't know what's going to happen, and God forbid there is another episode like this. But don't you hope that we have all the PPE we need, all the ventilators we need, all the vaccine rollout, test and trace rollout, schemes, furlough, everything set up, ready to go, so we can just get into default mode and fucking do it if we ever deal with this again? I do. And whose job is that? The health secretary's. So yes, mate, Sajid Javid, you say that you can get us out of this as quick as you can. I hope you're right, but I hope you're taking into account that massive list of things. And I'm sure I've missed out loads. Feel free to message me on Instagram and hit me with them. Although, actually, all of that being said, you know, even if he kind of half does some of it, surely he can't leave a worse lasting impression than Matt Hancock. Surely this is like the best advantage, the most flying start he could ever ask for. So in a way, my advice to him would be, don't push it and overpromise, because you're already chips up in comparison to your predecessor. Right, that's a lot. Sorry that it got a bit bleak towards the end, but I don't want to sugarcoat the reality of this to you. And I hope this has given you a much broader understanding of this whole affair. Pun intended. Listen, if you find this podcast helpful, please become a patron. It's the only way that I can keep going. The link is in the episode description. Just click it, you buy me a coffee, and it opens up a whole world of access to loads of exclusive content, opinion pieces, videos, even bonus podcasts. Follow me on social media at @JuliaBell_X on Twitter and Instagram. Send me messages. Tell me that you're enjoying the episodes. Shoot me over questions for future ones. And I said it at the beginning, I'll say it again. Share. Please share the shit out of this podcast. It's how I grow. It's how I get new audiences. It's organic word of mouth. All right. Thank you for listening. I love you guys. I'm going to go on that date now. Goodbye.